called my friend Vern, and I got a copy of her tape. And I played it. And even though I unfortunately never have had the privilege in this life to meet Doc, Bob, or Bill, I can envision them at a meeting listening to that tape. And I'm sure that Doc Bob would have kind of reeled over and said to Bill, "That skirt's got quite a message." Now, I'm not so slow, or at least I don't think I'm too slow upstairs, but I can tell you that in the 6 weeks that I've had that tape, I have listened to it in its entirety 8 times. And each time I listened to it, it has enriched my program, and her message of strength and hope has been a real benefit to me. And I know that every person in this room tonight, perhaps to a various degree, will have their program enriched. And with that, I give you Patty O.
Thank you. I'm Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me here. I'd like to thank Mel and Dolores for picking me up at the airport. The Al-Anon speaker was coming in about the same time I was, and Mel and Dolores were there to pick her up. And since I was arriving at about the same time, they asked them to pick me up, too. And I don't know if any of you have ever had the experience, but it's a little frightening for me when I'm getting off an airplane in a town where I don't know anybody, and I'm going to be coming out the little chute, and somebody's going to be there to pick me up, but I don't know who. And I don't know what they look like, and I don't think they know what I look like. I mean, I don't look like an alcoholic, so it's difficult to pick me out of a crowd. And it's a little frightening to me. And I came out of the chute at the airport, and I kind of looked around, and I see these three people on the other side of the waiting area talking and laughing amongst themselves, not paying any attention to anybody getting off the airplane. And I walked up to them, and I said, "I think you're waiting for me." And they were. And I don't know how much Al-Anon experience any of you have, but my opinion is, in Al-Anon, that's tremendous recovery. Not one of those three Al-Anons was concerned about the alcoholic. Breakfast this morning by myself at one of the little restaurants in town, and a young man was sitting at the table in front of me, and he turned around and started talking to me, and he reads the other big book, and he was telling me about the other big book, and he was telling me about God, and he was telling me about the path that he's walking, and he's walking a different path than we are, but he's going to the same place. And he told me that God was really a powerful dude, and he said, "You know, that dude can breathe life into people where there is no life." And I asked him to come to this meeting tonight, because I asked him how he knew that, and he said that he had read about it. And I assured him that if he came here tonight, he would see what he had read about, the experience that he had read about. I believe that we're a room full of people who God has breathed life back into. And for that, I am eternally grateful. The book tells me that I'm supposed to tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. The story I like to tell is that I was a Kansas City housewife. I sat on the sofa and I drank a little white wine. One day I burnt the toast and I realized my life was unmanageable. And I rushed to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got here and I looked at your 12 steps of recovery. I knew they were the solution to my life. I worked them in a week and I skyrocketed to recovery. Now that's a story I like to tell. Unfortunately, that isn't my story. I was responsible one time for a fire that gutted the entire inside of a house. Now, I imagine somewhere in that house there was a loaf of bread. Consequently, I did burn the toast. But it certainly wasn't enough to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to tell you right from the beginning, I am not a lawyer. Nor am I a runner. however, I do run daily from my bedroom to the bathroom, and that's the extent of it. I need to tell you a little bit about me before I started drinking. For those of you who are new or relatively new, I want to tell you that I didn't know anything about me until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and began recovering here. When I got to AA, I didn't know that I had a story. If I had known when I was out on the streets that I was putting a story together, I would have done things a little differently. So the things that I'm going to share with you tonight, I have just recently discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't walking around with this information before I came to you. I don't know about you, but I always get nervous when speakers are standing up here and they start out by saying, I was born. You know, especially if they're old. I mean, you just know you're going to have to listen to them for a long time. So I'm going to start out by saying I was born February 3rd, 1949 in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. And now that doesn't mean anything to any of you, but it's real important to me. Because, you see, up until that day, everything in my life was fine. up until that day, I had enough of everything, and everything that I had was just the right kind. From the day I was born until just recently in Alcoholics Anonymous, nothing has been enough, and nothing has been the right kind. I was born guilty. My father left us right after I was born. I wasn't even home from the hospital yet. And I assumed responsibility for that. If I hadn't been born, he wouldn't have left. And if he hadn't left, he and my mother and my brother would have lived happily ever after. So I was born guilty. I know a lot about guilt. I'm one of those people, I walk down the street and I see a little pile of guilt. I ask if it belongs to anybody. And if nobody claims it, then I pick it up and I put it in my pocket and I walk down the road till I get to another little pile of guilt and I ask if it belongs to anybody, and it doesn't. I pick it up and I put it in my pocket. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous with an awful lot of guilt, and I started picking it up from the day I was born. My mother went to California on vacation when I was four, and she told my brother and I she'd bring us back a souvenir from California, and she did. She brought us back a new father, which was a little more than I had bargained for, but this man walked into the house, and I knew that if he got a look at me, he was going to see the same terrible, awful things that my own father must have seen. He was going to see the same bad things that made my father leave. So I ran and hid underneath the bed, and I would have stayed there forever. Unfortunately, we moved to California, and when the moving people came and took the furniture, I had to get out, and I had no choice. And it seemed like that was a pattern that followed me throughout my life. I just never had a choice. My parents told us that we were being raised with love, and I believed them. Any more of their love, and I would have died. Their love was physically and emotionally and mentally abusive. I made a commitment as a very small child that I would never love another human being. You see, I knew that if I loved you, I was going to have to hurt you. And if I let you love me, you were going to hurt me. And so as a small child, I made a commitment that I would never love another human being. And I never said the words, I love you, in my entire life. I remember once I was about 8 years old and we were watching television, and it was something real dramatic, a real tearjerker. Lassie had come home or something, and I was crying because Lassie had come home, and my family was laughing at me because I was laughing. I was crying, and I made a decision at 8 years old that I would never cry again. I knew that if I cried, you were going to hurt me, and I just stopped crying when I was 8 years old. And we were raised Catholic as much as that's possible. I'm still recovering from that, but and a part of my story that I've never understood, and I still don't understand it, and maybe, you know, someday someone will explain it to me, but my mother was going to hell because she remarried. And because she remarried so that my brother and I could have a father, my brother and I had to go to confession every Saturday. Now, I never understood that. I still don't understand that. I was just a little kid. I wasn't into any heavy sinning yet. And I would go every Saturday to confession, and I would tell the priest the same boring sins week after week after week after week. I knew he was bored with it. I was bored with it. So one day when I was 12, I did this thing that I like to call creative confession. I got some books and some magazines, and I read, and I took notes, and I wrote down. And my whole intent was to put a spark in that man's afternoon. My whole intent was to do something for another human being. And so that Saturday when I was 12 years old, with my creative confession in my hand, I went off to the confessional. And I want to tell you, that confession worked really well. The priest was breathing hard by the time I was done. He had said, "My God," a number of times. And I came out of the confessional, and I really felt good. Now, I have to tell you, I'm 36 years old, and I still have not done some of the things I told that priest. I have done a few of them, though, in the last year, and I'm really sorry I've waited so long. Really good when I walked out of there, and I had that good feeling all the way till the next day. Now, if you're a good Catholic family, after Mass, you hang out in front of the church, and that way everybody else knows that you're a good Catholic family because you're hanging out. So we were hanging out the next day, and the priest went to my father, and he told my father the things I had told him in the confessional. And my father took me home and beat me, and I understood that that meant that he loved me. But I made a decision that day never to trust another human being, that if you knew anything about me, you were going to use it to hurt me. And I became what I like to call pathologically private. I didn't tell you anything that was going on with me, and pretty soon I couldn't tell me anything that was going on with me. And you see, all through my life, what I was doing was real simple. I was just building walls to keep you out. I just didn't want to be hurt anymore. And so I built these walls so that you couldn't get too close. And those walls worked really well. They kept you out. And the thing that I didn't know about those walls was they made me a prisoner inside. And I knew isolation and loneliness. And I didn't know that's what I knew. I believe God was very gentle with me. God let me find alcohol when I was 13 years old. I believe today that if I hadn't found alcohol, I would have had to blow my brains out. And I had my first drink when I was 13. I was on a camping trip with a group of girls, and somehow I had gotten a hold of a bottle of vodka, and I don't know where it came from. I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I had no illusions about alcohol. But I remember being real excited about having that bottle. And we got into the tent that night. I pulled the bottle out, and I asked if anybody wanted any, and nobody did. And the reason they gave me for not wanting any of that vodka is all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, "So what?" And I took the top off, and I drank half the bottle. And I looked around, and nothing had gotten different, and nothing had changed, so I drank the second half of the bottle. And that was the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And nothing happened. About 15 minutes later, the only thing that happened was that I had to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent. We were camped at the beach, and I kind of shuffled down to the outhouse. And I went in there and went to the bathroom, and when I got done and I went to get up off the toilet, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move my eyelids. I didn't think I was breathing. I couldn't feel anything going on. And I was overcome with an absolute sense of fear. And the fear was that somebody else was going to have to use that outhouse, and there I was paralyzed to the toilet seat. Now, later in my drinking, I discovered that two people can use the same toilet at the same time if the second person is very careful about what they're doing. But I didn't know that then. So what I did was I got all the energy I could get from anywhere in my body. I got it till it all seemed to be in one central location. And when it seemed to be there, I fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and I started crawling back to the tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have learned that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy that I was in the Marines and I was being dive-bombed while I was trying to get back to the foxhole. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I started to throw up, and I couldn't quite get through it, and I couldn't get around it. And under those circumstances, it's sometimes a little difficult to have a good attitude. Somehow, and I hope it was by the grace of God, I got back to the tent, I fell in, and I passed out. When I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they had gone until my eyes cleared enough that I realized that I had been sick all night long. I had thrown up. I had gotten the top of the tent, the sides of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch, and I didn't want to be in there either, and I got out of the tent. Fortunately, it was my parents' tent, so I just folded it up and took it home and put it in the garage. My father's an alcoholic, and what alcohol did for him was it made him disappear. And see, nobody told me my father was an alcoholic, and nobody told me that the things going on in my house were a result of alcoholism, and nobody told me that. The only thing I knew was that every once in a while, Dad would disappear, and he'd be gone for a couple weeks, and then he'd come back. And whenever he came back, We went on these big family camping trips, kind of to bring the family back together and reunite everybody. And he came back from one of those trips of his right after I had my first drink, and they were planning a big family camping trip. And I don't remember what was going on in my life, but it was very important that I couldn't go along that weekend. And they went. I remember right after they got back, they bought a new tent. But no one ever said anything to me about it. And that's the way my family was, and that's the way my family is, and I suppose that's the way my family always will be. All these folks lived together, and if you did anything to make anyone happy, they didn't talk about it. If you did anything to make anyone unhappy, they never talked about it. I never heard the words, I feel, or it makes me feel like. Nobody ever talked about feelings in my house. Anyway, that was my first drink of alcohol, and it was wonderful. It was the most exciting thing that had ever happened to me. It was the most wonderful experience I'd ever had, and it must have been, because I put some amount of alcohol into my body every day after that until I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always drink the things that you would consider a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. Are there any vanilla extract drinkers here? I used to buy it by the six-pack. And I would drink five bottles, and then halfway through the sixth bottle, I would suddenly remember what happened to me after a six-pack of vanilla extract. And what would happen to me after a six-pack is that my heart would start beating so hard I could see it coming out of my chest. I would start to sweat, and then I would be freezing cold, and then my legs would be weak, and they wouldn't hold me up, and I'd fall to the ground. And I'd think I was going to die, and then I'd be afraid I wasn't going to die, and then I'd hope I would die. And the first 10 minutes after a six-pack of vanilla extract are absolute hell. If you live through the first 10 minutes, it's a wonderful high. And for me, that's what I believe the insanity of the disease of alcoholism is. It wasn't the things I did after I drank. It was what my head did or didn't tell me before I picked up the first drink. And my head never told me about that first 10 minutes until I was halfway through the sixth bottle. We lived in a small town at the time, and I remember the day the manager of the market called me over and he said, Patty, so I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore. So I can't believe anybody vapes as much as you do. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I was one of those folks that came to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. And it doesn't taste as good as some of the other things, but when you're sweating off a Taboo drunk, you're not nearly as offensive to the people around you. I went away to college. I graduated from San Diego State with a 3.8 grade point average. I went on and took the classes for my master's degree. That almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I came here, I knew I was too smart to be an alcoholic. No one can graduate from college with a 3.8 grade point average and be an alcoholic. Being too smart to be an alcoholic almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I finished school, and I was on my way to Chico, California, which is at the northern end of California, and I was in San Diego, which is at the southern end. And the reason I was going to Chico is I had a friend from high school who lived there, and she had written me a letter and said, when you finish school, why don't you come up here to start working? And nobody had said, why don't you come, for a long time. So this letter from her was the only invitation I had. So I left San Diego. I packed everything I had into my car. I had two cases of beer and two bottles of booze, and I headed for Chico, California. I got to Santa Ana, which is about 66 miles north of San Diego. I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. And I pulled off the freeway, and I don't know about you, but I have a sense. I can find the sleaziest bar without even looking for it. I pulled off the freeway into a parking lot. I walked into this place. It was full of smoke. It had that wonderful smell of week-old booze. Somebody had thrown up at the front door several weeks before that, and they hadn't cleaned it up. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. And that's as far north as I ever got, 66 miles from where I started from. Alcohol controlled where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from, and I didn't know it. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I had put alcohol into an alcoholic body when I was 13 years old, and from that day on, I had no choice. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous as a direct result of one more drunk driving assault charge. I had to come to AA to find out you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And I was a bar drinker. I did all the things women bar drinkers do. I did a lot of things men bar drinkers do. I was never real particular about my behavior. But if you're a bar drinker, you have to get home from the bar. And I had been arrested enough times to realize that I had a driving problem. It never occurred to me that it had anything to do with the alcohol. I definitely had a driving problem. And so I would walk home from the bar, and then I would get arrested for drunken public assault. So one night I did this thing that I really thought was clever. I hid out in the bar when they locked it up that night, and that night I got arrested for breaking and entering assault. And I never got it that it had anything to do with the drinking. It was you and they and them. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was my boss. It was my instructors. It was my roommates. It was a lot of things. I never once considered that it had anything to do with alcohol. It was you and they and them. It was circumstances and conditions. My last drunk driving assault charge was in Orange County. The Orange County Sheriff has absolutely no sense of humor. I'm one of those people, when I get released from jail, I get the arrest report because I want to find out where I made my mistake so that I can practice that part so that next time I can get that part right. And you see, I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time, so I would study those arrest reports. Well, on my last drunk driving assault charge, I had taken the field sobriety test so many times that I was really quite a master at it. And I was taking the test, and I had given myself an A+. I was really doing a fine job. And the last thing he asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before that, I had responded by saying, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, see, then I just confessed. So this time, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around. You think it's funny. He didn't think it was funny at all. I was turned around. He put the cuffs on me. He took me to Orange County Jail. And he put me in a cell with criminals. And I knew I didn't belong there. I mean, there were prostitutes there. There were thieves there. There were women there for beating their husbands, which I don't think is a crime, but they put him in jail for it anyway. And there were real criminals in that cell. And I knew I didn't belong there. So what I tried to do is I tried to organize a jailbreak. And I explained my plan very carefully to the criminals. We were going to get our coffee cups. We were going to bang them on the bars and make a lot of noise. When the marshal came to see what was going on, I was going to throw my arm out around the bar, get her around the neck, get her keys, and get out of there. And I explained this plan very carefully. And one of the criminals said to me something that I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. This woman looked at me and she said, "Why don't you sit down and shut up?" I said, "Fine, then you all stay, but I'm getting out." And I got my coffee cup. I was going like a mad woman on the bars. Now, there's a couple problems with styrofoam cups. The first one is they don't make a lot of noise. The second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. When the bars ate them up and I got to my knuckles and it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. And they came to the cell a couple hours later, and they called my name, and I was being released on an OR. And I hadn't been released from jail on an OR in a very long time. And I knew they were making a mistake, but I wasn't going to be the one to tell them about it. And they took me to a telephone, and they told me I could make one phone call. And I stood by that telephone for 5 minutes, and I could not think of one person that I could call to come pick me up from Orange County Jail. I certainly couldn't call anyone in my family, and there was nobody that I considered a friend that I could call to come pick me up from Orange County Jail. And I knew isolation and loneliness, and I didn't know that's what I knew. And after about 5 minutes, the name of a woman who had worked for me at one time went through my head. And I called her, and with that alcoholic arrogance, I didn't ask her. I told her to come pick me up at Orange County Jail. And she did. She came and got me, and she took me back to my car. And as I was getting out of her car, she looked at me, and she said, "Patty, I don't ever want to see you again. I don't want to hear from you, and I don't want to hear about you. And as far as I'm concerned, you no longer exist." And she drove off, and I gave her one of these, and I said, "Fine, then I'll do it myself." I had been raised all of my life to know that if I needed anything done, then I better do it, because I couldn't depend on you and they and them. And if I couldn't do it, it didn't need to get done. And I didn't need her, and I didn't need you, and I didn't need anybody. And I got in my car, and I did the only thing I knew how to do. I went to the bar, and I told the guys how they had done it to me one more time. One more time, the Orange County Sheriff had it out for me. One more time, they had done it to me. One more time, it was circumstances and conditions. And I sat in the bar and I drank, because it's the only thing I knew how to do. I went to court on that drunk driving assault charge. I was 26 years old and I was drunk. It was the only way I knew how to go to court was drunk. It was the only way I knew how to do anything was drunk. And I didn't know that. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. My son was 8 months old when I went to court on that last drunk driving assault charge, and the judge was threatening to put me in jail for 5 to 10 years. And I stopped him, and I said, "Well, Your Honor, you can't put me in jail. I have an 8-month-old son. I'm a single parent. I'm self-supporting through my own contributions, and you can't put me in jail." And he looked at me, and I'll never forget the look on his face and the tone of his voice. And he looked down at me, and he told me he was going to put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother. I would have admitted to being a lot of things. I knew I was a lot of things, but I truly did not believe I was an unfit mother. I got that kid up at 6 o'clock every morning, whether he wanted to get up or not. I got him dressed. I put him in one of those plastic things that you put kids in when you don't want to touch him. And I took him with me down to the bar. Now, I'm not proud of this, but he spent the first 11 months of his life in one of those plastic things sitting on a pool table in a smoke-filled, dirty bar. But I believe that because I had him with me made me a fit mother. He is eternally grateful to you that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, mostly because he's too big to fit in one of those little plastic things anymore. But the judge was going to put him in a foster home, and he was going to put me in jail for 5 to 10 years. And in the middle of sentencing me, he did something that I had never seen before, and I knew he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing, because in the middle of it, the expression on his face got different, the tone of his voice changed. And he looked down at me and he said, "I know this isn't going to work for you, but I'm going to give you one more chance." And he offered me an alternative, and part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I wish I could tell you I left that courtroom and I went to my first AA meeting. I looked at the 12 steps to recovery, worked them in the first week, and skyrocketed to recovery, but I didn't. In retrospect, I can tell you that I drank for the next 3 months with a desperation and a sense of urgency that I had never known before. I couldn't have drank a greater quantity of alcohol. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol, but I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known before. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what I was doing with this alternative that he gave me, on that day I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the end of my drinking, I was one of those drunks that would pass out at 4 and come to at 6. And when I came to, I was late. I didn't know what I was late for, but I was late. And I would leap out of bed, which is fine if you're in bed. There were a lot of nights I didn't quite make it to bed, and I'd be on the living room floor, and it's a little uncomfortable to leap up from there. And then there were the nights that I would pass out in the back seat of my car, and it's real uncomfortable if you leap up and you're in the back seat of your car. And then there's the nights that for some reason I would pass out and roll underneath my car. And it is very painful if you leap up and you're underneath your car. And that was how I spent the last 2 years of my drinking. And on October 4th, 1975, I woke up very gently at noon. And I hadn't been asleep till noon in a very long time. And I hadn't woke up without that emergency for a very long time. And I can't tell you what I did that day, but I did whatever I did. And that night I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because that was my experience, I know for me beyond a shadow of a doubt that my sobriety was a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God, because, you see, I didn't put any alcohol in my body that day. I had had my first drink when I was 13, and I had not gone a single day without putting some amount of alcohol or some chemical into my body. It never once occurred to me to even try to go a day without drinking. The thought to try and go a day without drinking had never even gone through my head. It never occurred to me that it was the alcohol. It never occurred to me to try living life without drinking. I never tried to control my drinking. I would periodically try to control my behavior, but I never tried to control my drinking. And that day, I didn't put any alcohol in my body, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish I could tell you I skyrocketed to recovery from that moment on, but I didn't. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. The best I can describe myself when I came here is I was an animal with latent human tendencies. I had a tremendous amount of anger when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I acted it out in violence. I was one of those people who would... You probably don't have any like this in Oregon, but I would go to speaker meetings and I would sit in the back of the room, and if the speaker was saying something that I didn't like or I didn't agree with, I would stand up and tell him or her exactly what I thought of him. And it wasn't ever constructive, and it wasn't ever positive, and it wasn't ever very pleasant. I used to say that I talked like a truck driver. And then I had an opportunity to drive cross country, and I stopped at a lot of truck stops. And truck drivers do not talk the way that I used to talk. So then I used to say I talk like a sailor. And then I went to some meetings in San Diego, and sailors do not talk the way that I talked when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. You people made a lot of mistakes when I was new. You gave me your phone numbers, and I used them. I like calling you at dinner time. I especially like calling people who had talked in meetings about getting into relationships. I like calling them at bedtime. My absolute favorite, though, was to call at about 3 in the morning and just breathe hard. I heard you in meetings. You told me that it was easy to be serene for an hour and a half in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was easy to have serenity. It was easy to be an example of recovery in a meeting. You told me to follow you between meetings and see what you did between meetings. So I did that. I would follow you after meetings to coffee shops. Now, I wouldn't come in. I mean, God knows I don't want anybody to see me sitting with a table full of alcoholics. But I would find the Easy Does It bumper stickers on the car, and I would let the air out of 2 of the tires. Now, I know it's not effective to let the air out of just 1 tire, so I'd let the air out of 2 tires, because I wanted to see how serene you really were. And then I would hide in the bushes. And you would come out of the coffee shop, and you would walk up to your car, and you'd look at it, look at the other tire, kind of shrug your shoulders, nod your head, get into the car with somebody else, and drive off. And I absolutely did not understand that kind of behavior. I was the kind of person, the only tool I ever carry in my car is a hammer, because it's the only one I know how to use. And I always had bad luck with cars. I had those kind of cars that were never real dependable. And I had this one time, and one more time it stopped running while I was on the freeway. And I kind of coasted off the side of the road. I lifted the hood. I tapped on the engine a little bit, it wouldn't start. I tapped a little harder, it wouldn't start. I tapped really hard on it, and it wouldn't start. I finally ended up beating the engine to death, walking off the freeway, calling my mechanic, telling him to get the thing off the freeway, and he did. And about 4 days later, he called me, and he told me that my original problem was I had run out of gas. And it was going to cost me $800 for a new engine. And that's how I handled things like that. I did not understand you getting in your car, shrugging your shoulders, nodding your head, getting into a car and driving off with somebody else. And that's how I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the condition I was in when you got me. I had to stay here for a long time to discover for me that anger was a cover for a tremendous amount of fear. I was absolutely scared to death. I was afraid of you. I was afraid of life. I was afraid of me. And I had survived out on the streets. I had survived in the institutions. I couldn't tell you I was afraid. I couldn't even tell me I was afraid. And so I covered that fear with a tremendous amount of anger. And it took a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous before I could look at that and before I could see the fear that was there. But anyway, my first meeting was a speaker meeting, and I heard two things at that meeting. I heard the speaker say that we don't drink between meetings, which made me extremely nervous. I could not figure out what I was going to do with all my time if I didn't drink. And the other thing I heard him say was that the answers were in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I have to have the answers. I can't tell you how irritated I was when I got home. Not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one, and that's humiliating. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I really thought that was obsessive. As a matter of fact, I really couldn't figure out what else you were going to tell me. You had already told me I couldn't drink between meetings, and the answers were in the book. I could not imagine what else it was that you could possibly tell me. But I was willing to go to any length to stay out of jail. So I made a commitment to go to those 2 meetings a week. But I didn't want A&A to interfere with my busy life. And I certainly didn't want it to interfere with my social life. And I didn't want it to interfere with television. So on the way home from that first meeting, I stopped and I stole a TV guide. I mean, God knows, you know, I have to know. So I got home and I didn't just read the TV guide, I analyzed it. I got legal size sheets of paper. I wrote down all the days of the week. I wrote down all the programs. I read the little paragraph about each of the programs. I gave them all number ratings. I mean, it's like a 2-hour process I'm going through. Never once in that 2 hours did it ever occur to me that I didn't own a TV. That thought never went through my head. What happened, though, was that my next available night to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was Wednesday. So Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I went to my second meeting. And I heard in that meeting, I heard you tell me, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was that you had that you thought was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. Some of you had nice jewelry. I knew how to get that. Some of you had nice cars. I knew how to get those. Some of you had nice spouses. I knew how to get them. I could not figure out what it was that you had that you thought was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. And then I saw him. And I truly, not that kind, shame on you. I truly believe there's a hymn for each of us. This fellow was a skinny little man. He wore baggy pants with a thin belt. He was bald-headed. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I figured if I had to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted to do it his way. You see, because I figured out right away we shoot heroin, because folks who shoot heroin nod out. And if I had to do it without drinking, I wanted to do it his way. So I found out where he worked, and the next day I snuck down to his office, and I went in and I said, "Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it." And he told me that if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, he said, "I'll guarantee you, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different." And I believed him, and I hadn't believed a human being in a very long time, but I believed him. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my relationships would get better, my finances would get better, my employment would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. So, it's a little hope for the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here tonight, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. And if I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. You see, that thing in my head that tells me if it's good for me or bad for me, that thing's broken. Usually when I'm going through something that I think is good for me, it turns out to be bad for me. And if I'm going through something that I think is bad for me, it turns out to be good for me. And I don't know good from bad for me, but I sure do know what different is. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way, because I have never had it so good. And if I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. The steps for me were, step one was not something that I worked. Step one was something that I admitted. I was 8.5 months sober. I had heard a speaker at a meeting one night say that he knew he was alcoholic because he was driving home one night on a dark, windy road, and he heard his voice from his belly button tell him that he was alcoholic. So I said, "All right, God, if you want me to be an alcoholic, I want to hear my voice from my belly button as I'm driving down a dark, windy road at night. I mean, if you can do it for that yo-yo, you can certainly do it for me." Well, I did a couple of things. I stopped driving on dark, windy roads. I rarely drove at night, and when I did, I wore a lot of clothes, because I have to tell you, if I'd have heard my voice coming from anywhere, I'd have gone off the road. And it didn't happen for me that way. The way it happened for me is I was 8.5 months sober. As obsessive as I thought it was, I was coming to the two meetings a week that the court told me to go to. Dick had told me to read the book, so every day I would open it to chapter 3, and I would read, "Many of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics." I'd say amen and close the book. That was reading the book. I would go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach. I'd have a cup of coffee, and on the way out, I'd say, "Hi, Jim," and he'd say, "Hi, Pat," and that was talking to another alcoholic. And after 8.5 months of doing that, I was driving home one day, and it just occurred to me that I was an alcoholic. And for me, it took 8.5 months of not drinking to get far enough away from my last drink to see what my relationship to alcohol had been. It took 8.5 months of not putting alcohol or any other chemical into my body to get far enough away from my last drink to see what my relationship to alcohol had been. The evidence of my alcoholism was piled this high. You people could see it, and you gave me the dignity to come here and do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it. Nobody told me I had to be an alcoholic. The only thing you ever told me in Alcoholics Anonymous was to keep coming back. You let me do the things I had to do. You let me stand up in the back of the room and scream profanities at the speaker. If you came up to me after a meeting to talk to me, I would take a swing at you or I'd throw my coffee at you. I threw a chair through a plate glass window one night at a meeting because somebody said something I didn't like. I was 6 months sober and a man had shared something. I took offense at it and I jumped him after the meeting. I was beating his head into the floor. It took 6 men to get me off of him, and when they did, I knew they were going to throw me away. And one of those men looked at me and he said, "Patty," he said, "next time you feel that volcano about to explode," he said, "just put your hands in your pockets and don't touch another human being." And I wondered how he knew about the volcano. Nobody had ever talked to me about the volcano before, and it was the only thing I had felt in a very long time. This volcano would go off inside of me, and I had to do something. I had to hurt someone, preferably you. I never liked the sight of my own blood. That thing would go off, and I had to do something. And that man told me just to put my hands in my pockets and not touch another human being, and you never threw me away, and you just told me to keep coming back. And at the end of 8.5 months, I got far enough away from my last drink to see what my relationship to alcohol had been, and I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. Step two for me was not something that I worked. Step two was something that I came to believe. I came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity, and what that means for me is I came to believe that the day would come that I wouldn't have to act on every thought that I had. You see, being raised Catholic, one of the things the nuns told us, and I have to say this, it wasn't always what the Catholic Church said. A lot of times it was how I heard it. A lot of times I heard things differently than how they said them to me. Now, I'm not letting them off the hook 100%. But a lot of it was not so much what they said, it was how I heard it. An example of that, I had when I was going to college, I was poor. I couldn't afford to buy a car, so I bought a 750 Yamaha. And we lived in an apartment building, and we lived in the fourth apartment, and the garages were underneath the first apartment. And I would come home after the bar closed. I would get home at 2:30, quarter to 3 in the morning, and I'd race the motorcycle into the garage. Now, if you're a motorcycle rider, you know that before you turn it off, you have to rev it up and blow all that stuff out of the pipes before you turn it off. So I would pull into the garage, I'd rev it up, I'd turn it off, I'd go upstairs and go to bed. One morning, my roommate said to me, she said, you know, Patty, I can hear, when you come home in the morning, I can hear that motorcycle up here on the fourth floor. Can you imagine what it sounds like to the people who live right above the garage? And that's what she said to me, and I went off, and I went to school, and I went to work, and I went to the bar. And that night when I came home, I remembered what she said to me. So instead of pulling it into the garage and revving it up, I rode it up four flights of stairs. I crashed it through our living room door, into the living room, onto the white carpet. I revved it up, I turned it off, and I went to bed. Now, that isn't what she said to me, but that was how I heard it. I have to tell you, it was a real pain in the neck getting that thing downstairs the next morning. So it wasn't always what you said to me. Still today, it isn't always what you say to me. A lot of times, it's how I hear it. But what I heard the nuns say was, I heard the nuns tell me that I was going to burn in hell for just as long for thinking it as I was for doing it. And I've always been a kind of into action person. And I figure if I'm going to burn for thinking it, I'm going to get some pleasure out of doing it. I did a lot of things that I didn't even want to do. But I figured if I'm going to think them, I'm going to do them. And I came to believe in step two that the day would come when I wouldn't have to take an action on every thought that I had. I'm happy to tell you that that has been my experience at Alcoholics Anonymous, because later in the book, in the discussion of step 10, it says, for this time, sanity will have been restored. And that has been my experience. I don't have to act on every thought that I have today, and I'm grateful for that. I've had four lust attacks just standing at this podium tonight. Take action on those things today. I may later, though, at the dance. Step three for me was not difficult at all. I hear people in AA talking about how hard step three is. Step three was not difficult at all for me. When my back was against the wall, the pain was so great, it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. I looked at step three and I saw that it said made a decision. I don't know about you, but I make a million decisions a day. I am really a good decision maker. My problem is taking the action to implement the decision. That's what I have. It was so great, it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. And, you know, if you look at it, I had made a decision on a daily basis to turn my will and my life over to the care of alcohol and drugs. I had turned my will and my life over to people even less qualified than myself a number of times. When my back was against the wall and it was do it or die, it was not difficult to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Step four I thought was cute. My degree is in journalism, and I figured step four was for those of you who really didn't have a lot of creative writing skills. For those of you who weren't writers, I figured that step four was for you. It certainly wasn't for me. And I was never going to do an inventory. I was never going to write an inventory. And I didn't for a long time. But what happened was, I would find myself in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would find myself feeling unique, feeling different than, feeling as though you didn't understand my problems, knowing that my problems were different than yours, knowing that if I shared with you, you were going to tell me something that wasn't going to apply to me anyway. And I started feeling that way more and more and more. And I was sitting in the middle of you, and I would leave a meeting in more pain than I had been when I came in. And I knew that I had to do something. I had to do something or I was going to have to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, because I could not continue to come here and be in that pain. So just on a lark, I wrote an inventory. And the thing that happened to me when I wrote my inventory was I felt a part of you again. When I wrote my inventory, I didn't write down anything that I didn't already know. Everything that I wrote down in that inventory, I was already aware of. No secrets came flying out of my pen. Nothing came onto that paper that I didn't know before I wrote it. And once I finished it, I felt a part of you again. And then I looked at step five, and I'm pathologically private. I am never going to tell you anything about me. I think step five is wonderful for those of you who were not raised Catholic. Because those of you who were raised Catholic have done confession, and we know it doesn't work. And so step five was for the rest of you who didn't know anything about confession. Now, I put my fourth step in the trunk of my car. I didn't want anybody to find it and read it by accident. So I put it in the trunk of my car, and then I drove around with an impending sense of doom and this horrible fear. And the fear was I was going to get rear-ended on the freeway. My trunk was going to fly open. My fourth step would be everywhere all over southern Orange County. But rather than do a fifth step, I chose to drive around with that fear and that sense of impending doom. I was in Los Angeles one night visiting a friend of mine, and we were talking, and suddenly occurred to me that I was doing a fifth step. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. So I went down to the car, and I got my inventory, and I went back upstairs. Now, I would not have picked this woman to do a fifth step with. This lady had 2 weeks less sobriety than I did. I would not have picked her to do a fifth step with. For me, my experience was God put the perfect person in front of me, because I would not have chosen her. And when I got done doing my fifth step, she looked at me, and she said, Patty, she said, one day the things that you have listed as your greatest assets will become your greatest liabilities. And the things that you have listed as your greatest liabilities will become your greatest assets. And I thought, oh, wonderful, I have just done a fifth step with a woman who has lost her last wing nut. This one is out to lunch. As I stand here tonight, I have to tell you that the things that I have always thought were my greatest assets have become my greatest liabilities. And the things that I have thought were my greatest liabilities have become my greatest assets. And I don't know how that happened. I have always been a very strong woman. I am still a very strong woman. Being a strong woman has become a liability for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, because what I do with my strength is I don't tell you when I need help. What I do with my strength is I shortchange myself rather than ask one of you to help me. I was at a meeting one night, and a woman who had a few years more than I did came up to me after the meeting and asked me if she could go home with me after the meeting because she was going to kill herself and she didn't want her husband and daughter to find her. Well, I have learned never to say no to an AA request. So I said, okay, fine, you know, come on over. So she came to my house. Now, I have never been suicidal. I don't understand suicide. I have one of those egos. I cannot figure out what the world would do without me. So I don't understand suicide. But we got to my house, and the first thing she did was she looked in my refrigerator. And she said, we don't have very much food here. I said, well, what are you carrying to kill yourself? And then she looked in the cupboard, and she said, well, this is even worse. She said, this will never do. We have to go to the grocery store. I was almost 5 years sober. I could not tell her that I could not do the grocery store. I can't do Alpha Beta. I can do stop and go okay. I can do 7-Eleven, but I can't do the grocery store. I can do fresh fruits and vegetables or meat, depending on what door I go in, but I can't do the grocery store. And I can't tell her because I'm almost 5 years sober. So we went off to the grocery store. I did white-knuckle grocery store shopping. I held on to that cart so tight. She threw things and I caught them in the basket. I have to tell you, I almost had a stroke. Do you know how expensive it is if you go up and down every aisle of the grocery store? And we walked out of the grocery store and I had one more freedom. I can do Alpha Beta today. I prefer stop and go. But I can go to the grocery store today because one of you took my hand and walked with me through that experience. And because she got out of herself to help another alcoholic, she didn't need to kill herself. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked one more time. But you see, by myself, I'll shortchange myself. My strength, every time I will deny myself of the freedom that's here in Alcoholics Anonymous if I ask one of you to take my hand and walk with me. And the things that I thought were my greatest assets become my greatest liabilities in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the things that I've always thought were my greatest liabilities become my greatest assets. I left that woman's house that night after I did my fifth step, and I went home and did step six and seven by mistake. The book Alcoholics Anonymous is really poorly written. I think it's written for about a retarded third grader. It isn't written well at all, but that one part right around step six and seven is real poetic. And I started reading, I just kind of was reading, I got caught up into it, and I read right into the middle of the seven-step prayer. As I was in the middle of the seven-step prayer and I realized what I was doing, I knew that I believed it. I knew that I believed what I was reading, and I finished reading the prayer, and the thing that it says in the book happened to me that night. I walked through the archway to freedom. When I finished reading that prayer and I knew that I believed it, I walked away from the person I had been all of my life. and I walked through the archway to freedom to start to become the person God intended for me to be. And as long as I continue to choose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I never have to be that person I was again one day at a time. As long as I continue to choose to recover here, I never have to be that angry, violent person again. As long as I continue to choose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have the opportunity to continue to become the person God intended for me to be. And that, for me, I believe, is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. If the magic hasn't happened for you yet, please stay with us long enough until you walk away from the person you have been all of your life and start to become the person God intended for you to be. Steps 8 and 9 for me were simply conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. When I had my list from my fourth step, and with that alcoholic arrogance, I looked at step 9 and I said, all right, God, if you want me to make amends, you put these people in my face because I'm not going out looking for them. And I want to tell you, people started showing up this quick. I had people in my face that I had forgotten to put on my list. I mean, they were coming. And I started making my amends. And two of my amends could have put me back in jail for a very long time. And I'm the person who came to Alcoholics Anonymous simply to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted. Two of my amends could have put me back in jail for a very long time. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, God love them, they pointed to me the part in the book that says that we don't have to make those amends if another person would be hurt. And they reminded me that my son was still living in my home, and I was still a single parent, and I was self-supporting through my own contributions, and if I was to go to jail, he would be hurt. And they told me I didn't have to make those amends, but you know what? I'm the person who lives with my gut. I'm the person who lives with what's going on inside of me. And I knew what was going on inside of me, and I knew that I needed to make those amends. And if it meant going to jail, then that's what I had to do. I also knew that I was no longer self-supporting through my own contributions. You see, I brought my son to Alcoholics Anonymous with me. He was 11 months old when I came here, and you would take him during the meeting, and you would hold him on your lap, and you'd bounce him, and you'd do whatever you do with kids. And you loved my son, and you loved him, and you loved him, and I couldn't, I didn't know how, but you would take him from me, and you loved him. And I wasn't one of those newcomers that you loved until I could love myself, but you tolerated me, and I'm grateful for that. And when you could, you started to love me, and then you taught my son and I how to love one another. And I knew that if I went to make those amends, if I was to have to go to jail, I knew that one of you would take my son, and that he would be loved in your home, and that you would take care of him for me, and I needed to go make those amends, and I did. And I'm the coward that came here to stay out of jail. I have to tell you that I made both of those amends and I never had to do a single day in jail, and I don't know how that happened. For that to happen is absolutely impossible. There is no way that I could go and make those amends and not have to do any time. But I didn't have to do a single day. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are the steps that I use on a daily basis that give me the privilege of coming and sitting with you in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis. Because I use steps 10, 11, and 12 in my life, I can come and sit with you and listen to you share your experience, strength, and hope. I can listen to you tell me how to live life, because I don't know how to live life. I don't have a clue. But because I use those steps, I have the privilege to sit with you in a meeting and listen to you tell me how to live. And because you share with me how to live life, I don't have to shortchange myself anymore. Step 10 for me is something that I do on a moment-to-moment basis. I don't wait till the end of the day. I don't like pain enough to go all day long with that pain. And then at night and take a little inventory and see where I've maybe hurt somebody and owe them amends. I don't like to go all day with that pain. I use step 10 at the moment, and I promptly admit it when I've been wrong. Step 11 for me is really very simple. I'm a very simple person. I wake up in the morning and I say, thy will be done. And when I say, thy will be done, I believe it for the rest of the day, and I believe that whatever it is I do for that day is God's will for me. I can't figure it out. I never could figure it out. So I wake up in the morning and I just simply say, thy will be done. And I go out there and I do the thing that you've taught me. I go out there and I live life. And step 12 for me is the opportunity to give away a little bit of what I've been given. And those three steps, I use those on a daily basis so that I have the privilege of coming and listening to you share your experience, strength, and hope with me. When I was a little over a year sober, I was at the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach, and a fellow who'd been around for about 20 days had drank that day, and he came into the club, and I talked to him for about 45 minutes, and then I had to go to the bathroom, which I thought when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was my only character defect, was weak kidneys. That has not been removed in the time that I've been here, but I went off to the bathroom. When I came back, he was gone. And I asked somebody where he went, and he said he left, and I went out into the parking lot, and he was in his car, and I asked him if he was okay. And he said, yeah, I'm going to go home and sleep it off, but I'll be back tomorrow. And I said, well, I hope so, because I love you. I was 27 years old, I was a little over a year sober, and that was the first time in my entire life that I had said the words, I love you, to another human being. And I didn't know what they meant, but I knew what it felt like, and it felt good. It wasn't that awful, terrible thing that I had learned love was all about. And as he drove out of the parking lot, I started to cry, and I hadn't cried since I was 8 years old. And the line in chapter 5 that says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. That line went through my head. And I knew that if I was to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was going to have to give myself completely to the simple program. And I was going to have to do the things that you had done. And that night, I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know for me that my sobriety was a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God. And my recovery is a choice. And I make the choice to recover on a daily basis. And as long as I continue to make that choice to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, then I have the privilege of coming here and letting you teach me how to live life. My son still lives in my home. I wish he'd get a job, but he's going to be 11 in November, and I really think it's time. But he was going to the YMCA day camp year before last, and they went to SeaWorld, which is kind of a zoo for fish. And they all went to SeaWorld for the day, and they were doing whatever kids do. And when I picked him up that afternoon from camp, he got into the car, and he gave me this Oriental fan that he had bought for me at SeaWorld. And I was overwhelmed with the love of Alcoholics Anonymous, you see, because my son was out with a group of his peers, and he was having fun, and he was doing whatever it is that kids do. And he took a moment out of his day, and he thought about me, and he stopped, and he got me a gift to bring back from SeaWorld. He said, I didn't come here for that. I didn't know how to love, and I couldn't have taught my son how to do that. You people taught him how to do that. You taught him to take a minute out of his day and think about another human being. And because he was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, because he's been raised with you, he may never have to know that self or self-centered thing that I lived with all of my life. Because he was raised with you, he may never have to live in bondage yourself, in that desperation that we've lived in for so many years. I know that our children have had the worst of our alcoholism, and I believe they deserve the best of our recovery. I believe that our kids need to be here. They need to be here, and they need the nurturing. They need the love. They need to feel the thing that happens here between one alcoholic and another. I have never been married. My son, you know, he has a father, because Mary didn't want me to be the second virgin, but my son has never known his father. And he has men in Alcoholics Anonymous who are absolute wonderful role models. He has had the opportunity to see men cry. He's seen men hug one another. He has men in his life that take him camping and they take him fishing. I wish they'd take me out on a date once in a while. But he has more opportunities than most kids do. And because he's been raised here, he's got a very positive attitude. Because he's been raised here, he has a tremendous compassion for new people in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's rare that he and I go to a meeting that he doesn't ask if we're going to the detox facility by where we live to pick up some new people to take to the meeting. He is always thinking about you. And I owe you that to you, because by myself, I couldn't have done that. I couldn't have taught him that. I didn't know it. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have been shortchanged. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have missed. I'd have missed my son's love. I'd have missed being able to love him as a mother is supposed to love her son. I'd have missed being able to love you and letting you love me. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself over and over and over again. We were at a Mother's Day luncheon at his school last year, and it's a real privilege for me, you know, because he should be living in somebody else's home. He shouldn't even be living in my house. It's a real privilege for me to do things, to participate in his life, to take him to basketball practice, to take him to Little League, to take him to baseball practice. You know, when you go there and you hear parents muttering about what an inconvenience it is, and they had to get off work early to do it. And it's a real privilege for me, because he shouldn't even be there. He should be living with one of you. And I had a real hard time when he was playing soccer, because I didn't know how to talk to normal soccer mothers. And I called my sponsor up, and I was panicked, and I said, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to talk to normal. I mean, they don't want to talk about vomiting blood. They don't want to talk about incomprehensible demoralization. I mean, I was having a real difficult time. And she told me that all I needed to do is what I did when I was new in AA. She said, just go stand there and pretend like you know what they're talking about. Just go stand there and act as if you're part of. So I did. I would just go hang out. Pretty soon, I was such a part of, they asked me to bring the Gatorade and to cut up oranges and to be there at 7 to work in the snack bar, and I became a part of, because I learned how to do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. But we were at this Mother's Day lunch, and I was dressed up, and I went up there, and I And my son and I guess we're weird. We hold hands. I get down on my knees so I can look into his eye when we talk to one another, because he taught me that I just had to treat him like I do one of you. And we finally got up to get our food, and the teacher was serving the food, and she looked at us and she said, you know, the two of you look like young lovers. And I said, we are. And we got our food and we went and sat down. And I started looking around the room, and I looked at the other mothers and I looked at their kids, and I knew that those other mothers loved their kids, and I knew the kids loved their mothers. And I wondered what the difference was. And I looked around the room, and it finally occurred to me that the difference between me and them was that they had never abused alcohol. They had never drank alcoholically into that deep, dark, desolate pit of alcoholism. They hadn't drank into that place of isolation and despair and then continued to drink deeper and deeper and deeper into that pit. They had never abused alcohol to that place of incomprehensible demoralization. They didn't know the pain. They didn't know the isolation. They didn't know the loneliness. They didn't know the degradation that I had known. And because they had never abused alcohol, nobody ever threw them 12 simple steps and said, take these steps and walk out of that pit. And walk out of that pit and stand on the ground, eye level to eye level with every other human being. Take these steps and walk out of this pit, and for the first time in your life, be right with every other human being. And because I'm right with you, I'm right with God. And because I'm right with God for the very first time in my life, I'm right with myself. Today my life is exactly right. Everything I have is enough, and it's exactly the right kind. And it never was that way before. I always needed another job, a different bank account, a different house, another car. If I had that relationship, I'd be okay, and I would get those things, and it wasn't enough, and it wasn't the right kind. Today my life, for the very first time, is exactly right. Everything I have is enough, and it's exactly the right kind. And it was real simple. When the pain was great enough, when I had no other choice, it was do it or die, I would take another one of those 12 steps and walk a little further out of that pit of isolation and loneliness, a little further out of that pit of despair. I like to end with a story that I heard that puts it all together for me, and it's the story of the man that goes to see St. Peter. And he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. And St. Peter takes him into a banquet room set up much like this with long tables of food. Any kind of food you could think of, as much food as you could ever imagine. Anything you'd want was on those tables. And the people in that room marked hell were hungry, and they were starving, and they were dying. And the reason they were starving is they had big wooden spoons tied to their hands, and the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. And so they sat amongst plenty, and they were starving. And that's the way I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was starving. And then he took him to a room marked heaven, and inside that room was exactly the same scene. Tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you could think of, any kind of food you could imagine. And the people in that room had those long wooden spoons tied to their hands too. And the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. But the people in that room were happy, and they were full, and they were content. And the difference was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man across the table. And the man across the table was taking a spoonful of food and feeding somebody else. And they were feeding someone else. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here and I have to let you feed me. And hopefully every once in a while I have an opportunity to give a spoonful of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to someone else. And you don't have to have a year or 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. If you've got one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman who's just walking in the door. If you have one day, you have something to give to the new person. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I always wish that I had something powerful to say, that I had a message, and I don't. The only two things that I know for sure, beyond a shadow of a doubt, because they've been my experience, is the thing that Dick told me. And by the way, that man that I thought was shooting heroin was 32 years sober. It shows you what my judgment of people is like. And he died when I was 2 years sober, and I made a commitment that as long as I had an opportunity to share in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would remember to share the thing that he taught me. If you don't drink, you won't get drunk. If you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And the other thing I know for sure, beyond a shadow of a doubt, because it too has been my experience, is the line in Chapter 5 that we heard read tonight. And it's a line that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.